Sheep Radio. My name is Andrew.
And I'm Tessa.
And for today's episode, we interviewed Norm Stockwell, who's the station operations coordinator at WORT-FM here in Madison. So we did this interview to talk with him about community radio and independent media and the station itself and kind of the story about the station, which I think is really interesting and kind of something that I think other people would find helpful.
Yeah, and one of the main reasons that Andy and I wanted to find someone at WORT to talk to and get into some of the history of independent media and how WORT has affected Madison as its independent local radio station is that we both highly value the idea of independent media and sort of seeing where it can be pushed and how it's being affected now, and also the difference between something like a radical movement publication that's aimed at a particular political goal and the goal of actually having a free press and how that helps movements as opposed to necessarily propaganda around particular movements. It's important to see the distinctions.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting here is that Tessa and I are both socialists, obviously, but I think we have a pretty different approach to media. A lot of people that are in Leninist-type groups have, like, a very ordered line paper, and that's never really been the way that we've approached media. And since a lot of our podcast is kind of on the theme of rethinking socialism or kind of having something in line with our own experience, we wanted to do something about media because media in a lot of ways is like one of the most political things that socialists do. So this episode, we kind of get into the very beginnings of a different theory about how to do media and the very radical conclusions of community and independent media.
Yeah, it's all about thinking about media as not just a tool for movements, but a movement of its own.
So, yeah, that's the episode in a nutshell, and it's about an hour long talking to Norm Stockwell, and we actually recorded it at the radio station, which so we got to do it in person, so the quality I think is a lot better. Tessa's mic had something wrong with it at the beginning, so it's a little messed up, but the rest of the interview is real nice and clean. So that's about it. You can find us online at goodonpaperpod.org or blacksheepradio.wordpress.com. We're on iTunes, and we just started Twitter. So just get in touch with us and enjoy.
Bye. Welcome to Black Sheep Radio. Today we're here with Norm Stockwell, who is the operations coordinator at WORT, which is the local Madison independent radio station. Welcome, Norm.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So we want to start off, just could you tell us a little bit about yourself, Norm? How did you get into independent media?
Well, I've been here at WORT since 1983, so just over 30 years. And I actually walked in the door here because I was running a folk music school in town, and I got involved with some of the folk music programming here on WORT, and then I drifted from there into news and public affairs, and I drifted from there into engineering, and I drifted from there into administration. And now since 1995, I've been the operations coordinator here on staff at the station. For me, media is about telling people's stories, and I've always been involved in some sort of cultural work. My political work has always been connected to culture, worked on a lot of different projects over the years, mostly around folk music and political art and so on. And for me, radio is a part of that. It's a part of culture. And so that's how I got into this and why I've stuck with it for so long.
Yeah, so would you say that you turned to independent media because of your politics, or did your politics sort of come out of your interaction with independent media?
Well, I mean, my politics come up from growing up in a progressive household and being involved in political activity since I was in a stroller, basically. In fact, I was actually in a stroller. And so for me, I've always been involved in some sort of progressive politics. The media stuff really came out of the cultural work that I've been involved in, which came out of the political work. And I kind of went from sort of a party politics view of the world into political culture, and from there into specifically community radio, and really from there into more broad-based independent media work.
So maybe we'll come back to that, but for the moment, I thought maybe you could tell us about a little bit about Wart, because Wart itself is, you know, somewhat of like a radio miracle. It's really similar to Pacifica in a lot of ways, but it's also independent. And you know, a friend of mine ended up working on staff for Pacifica, and you know, he came here and was totally surprised that there's so few staff that are able to keep the station running.
Yeah, well, I mean, Wart, as we sit here today, is getting ready to celebrate its 38th. anniversary. And if you look at the history of community radio in the United States, the first community radio station, of course, founded in 1949, April, if that matters, of 1949, by Lewis Hill, who was a conscientious objector during World War II and had also worked in media, decided that there should be a media that is A, not based on commercials, and so it's the non-commercial concept. But B, he said, all of the rest of the media is beating the drum for war. Mm. And this is, you know, the 1940s, right? And there needs to be a voice for peace. And that's really where Pacifica came from. Pacifica then became a model for the building of community radio stations across the U.S. And it's interesting, if you look at the history of community radio development, it tends to tie to political movements. So the early community radio stations were started in the early and mid-1960s and were based around sort of the beat generation, alternative culture, and so on and so forth. Early on got connected to the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. The next wave of community radio stations that you see comes up during the Watergate era. Mm-hmm. And that's where WRT comes from and several other stations around the Midwest. And the idea was people saying, we know that our government is not telling us the truth. We want someplace to get more information, more real knowledge about what's going on. And so these community radio stations started up, and several of them in the early 1970s. The people that put Wart together started doing that in 73, and the station actually went on the air in December of 1975. The next burst of community radio stations that you see in the United States is in the early 1980s, and it's the time of the Reagan administration and the Iran-Contra affair brewing in the mid-80s, of course, again, a case of people feeling that their government is not telling them all of the truth and wanting another voice on the air. And then something interesting happened in the 1990s, which was the low-power FM radio movement. And that grew out of initially what we would call vanity radio, people who were doing these pirate radio stations just to hear their voice on the air. But in the 80s, those groups began to become politicized. And so we saw in the 1990s a push for the creation of a low-power FM radio service of smaller stations than, our station here, WRT, is a full-power station. But these were smaller stations that served small local communities. And so that movement then grew and has continued to be involved and intertwined with all of the rest of independent media, which, again, if you look historically at sort of the ebbs and flows of the independent media movement, we have the first real independent media center that I'm aware of was in 1996 at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And I worked with those folks a bit. And then some of those people went on to Seattle for the WTO protests in 99. And we worked closely with them. We started an independent media center here in Madison at the same time. And, of course, around the country, you saw the blossoming of these independent media centers through the early 2000s, especially, but not always, tied to events that were happening, different protests, anti-globalization protests, and so on. And then the independent media centers spread around the globe. And today, perhaps a little bit more in ebb than in flow, but the independent media movement is certainly alive and well around the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I mean, there's a couple of questions I could ask you, but first, why don't you talk about Wart's actual process of coming together? Like, what happened that the station came out in the 70s, and what went into making an independent station?
Yeah, well, again, you know, you're looking at the times, the time of Watergate, the anti-Vietnam War protest, Madison certainly very involved in that. And you had a bunch of folks that were sort of radio geeks, half a dozen people who were involved in some way or other, mostly working at commercial radio or, in some cases, some of the early beginnings of cable TV here. They said, we really should have a radio station, and there's space on the dial, and they began organizing community meetings, potlucks. Mike O'Connor, one of the founders of the station, says it was sort of like the same $300 kept passing around from person to person, but eventually they raised enough money to get the station on the air, and it was kept quiet originally. They didn't want somebody else to know, hey, there's a frequency available here, let's jump on it, because nowadays with the internet, everybody knows all of that stuff. But back then, it was a little, the whole engineering was a little bit more arcane, and, you know, only the initiated knew, like, where the coverage maps were and things like that. And so it was a little more difficult to get a radio station going back then. So they knew of this frequency. They began the application process. They didn't talk about it a lot. Then they started raising money for the project. Then the station again was built and went on the air, initially in a rented facility with a rented tower and a rented transmitter, and then eventually in 1982 we moved to the building that we're in today with a new transmitter, a new tower location on the west side that's 1,000 feet in the air and gives us a very large signal footprint.
Yeah, so you're talking about it. It just sounds like such a community event, right? And people pool together, and I know that there's a huge volunteer part of WART. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how community radio and how WART is a different way for people to interact with the news than, say, corporate media or commercial media. Like, why is it so important to have that independent media, and what are some of the big differences?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two sides to that question, and I'm going to start with the obvious one. I mean, corporate media tends to represent the people who they get their money from, which is large corporations. And so the voices that you hear tend to be those that are comfortable to corporate media. The stuff that they cover tends to be issues that are comfortable to corporations. I mean, and the approach to news is basically you get the press releases from the top and you report those down to the people. Well, in community radio, we have a different model, and that is basically going from the bottom up. Instead of the press releases from the top down, we're going to the people who are affected by the policies and getting their stories and sharing those. And so the way that I like to differentiate it is that in community radio, our news philosophy is sort of giving people information about issues that affect their lives and giving them tools to become active around those issues. And so those are sort of three components of what we do. And commercial radio, for the most part, is trying to get more listeners so they can charge more money for their advertisers. And so their model is much more an infotainment model. So you'll see much more focus on, you know, big shocking things and so on. And our focus tends to be on real people's lives and their stories. Now, I wanted to say something else too, though, and this is not a diss on the world of podcasting where we are right now, but there's a huge difference, I think, between somebody sitting in their basement and writing news for a blog or a podcast or something by themselves, and the kind of interaction and cross-fertilization that takes place inside a community radio newsroom. And so here, you know, on any given day of the week, we produce a local news show, and there'll be a half a dozen people here working on stories and talking to each other and sharing ideas and resources and, hey, do you know so-and-so, and do you know anybody at the such-and-such? And so there's a much more interactive environment here, whereas most of what's happening in today's new media is somebody very closed in a little room, and maybe all they're doing is, you know, reposting other things off the internet, or maybe they're doing original work, but they're doing it by themselves. And so the community radio station, I think, offers something to people that is not available in a lot of the other new media platforms.
I couldn't agree with you more, and you stole one of my later questions to make the argument for actually community radio stations. And I think that we need to be taking a serious look at how the internet and new technology is affecting independent media and holding on to why those institutions are important and things can't just be replaced by the internet. There's a lot more to independent media than necessarily getting a different side of a story that you're reading on an article.
And now is maybe a good time to say that both Tessa and I are also station volunteers here at Wart who, you know, do a lot of community reporting and stuff like that. So,
yeah, know, and
brush that off.
Right. No, I think that that's really important, too, is the kind of interaction that's happening today between people that are doing new media things like you're doing with this podcast and also still being connected to, you know, a live community radio station newsroom. Similarly, most of the news that's on the internet started in a print newspaper.
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, the idea as we're seeing the decline of print journalism in the United States, as somebody once said, the medium formerly known as print, that the loss of that resource is really affecting all of internet journalism, as well as the fact that the print is simply not there anymore.
Well, do you want to talk a little bit about the kind of democratic impulse of community radio? Because, I mean, I think one of the things that's happening with the crisis of traditional print media is that people are really lamenting all this loss of information around them, where I remember for a while someone was saying that, like, Clear Channel had bought up all of these stations in rural communities, and then they didn't know about major weather things that were going to affect them, and it was leading to all kinds of problems. And, I mean, that's a bare-bones survival thing, but that's not even about informing about your life. And
yeah, there's a famous case of a chemical spill that happened in, I forget if it was North Dakota or South Dakota, and there was no local radio station there to report on it to tell people about the evacuation because they were all being fed from, computers in Texas or, mm-hmm. or California or whatever. And that's one of the things that community radio in the traditional sense, and I'm talking about full-power community radio stations like WRT, and the new low-power radio stations, which serve these really small targeted communities, can provide is that connection to the local community in ways that you can't get through these larger and larger conglomerations of corporate media. Here in Madison, except for our station and the public radio station, which is a statewide network, pretty much every other radio frequency on the dial is owned by three companies. And so you have a whole variety of stuff on the radio, but it's actually just three voices that you're hearing. And it's important to talk about this for a second, because I think one of the things that gets missed in this discussion of consolidation is that simply by its nature, consolidation is going to mean that the diversity of voices is reduced. Because capitalism says, you know, you have to operate in these efficiencies, right? And so that means, you know, in the case of Clear Channel Madison, which owns six stations, they have one engineer who does all the engineering work for those six stations. They have one sales team that sells ads for all those six stations. And so even if everybody in all of those six stations formerly was a Republican, you still have fewer people, so you have fewer voices, so you have less diversity of opinion, even if the opinions were all, you know, within a narrow spectrum. So as media consolidates, what we're losing is we're losing those different perspectives, different life experiences that people brought to the workplace and shared with each other and influenced each other accordingly.
Do you want to respond? I mean, I've heard occasionally, not often, but I have heard sometimes people that don't lament this loss at all, that they say that, like, well, who cares if the New York Times is kind of losing itself because it's corporate media anyway, and what does that matter to everybody else?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I mean, I think that the thing that we have still, and we have it less and less every day, but the thing that we have still with print media is people that are doggedly following stories, you know, that are doing that kind of long form journalism where they're going out and following a story for weeks or months, getting the details, doing the fact checking, coming up with these syntheses of information and then sharing that with people through the articles. That's got to be paid for somehow. I mean, not everybody who's doing media can be working for free. And, you know, we at WRT appreciate all the volunteers that come in here and produce all the shows, but in fact, people have to put food on the table. And so most of our volunteers, you know, work anywhere from 1 hour a month to 10 hours a week, but nobody's working 40 hours a week. In those print newspapers, people are working 40 hours a week, and they're getting paid to be there to do that meticulous journalism that is, you know, it's irreplaceable because it's the kind of hard work, the slogging through the details that gets the results that are then able to be distributed through websites and through other people then doing longer magazine articles based on the print research and so on and so forth. So all of it is really kind of a cascading loss when we lose those newspapers, even the ones that, yes, they are corporate media, but they're corporate media that have large newsrooms full of lots of reporters, or did have, that are doing this kind of research and this kind of in-depth work.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could go into not just how that's changing with the consolidation of corporate media or commercial radio and news, is just the change in technology, the moving towards the internet, because I think oftentimes it can be lost, and especially on the web, it can be lost how much goes into actually having a journalistic piece of news, you know, all that investigative journalism. And I liked what you said earlier. You said that so many things have been based off of print newspaper and people sort of don't really see that connection when they read it on the web, and why would I pick up an actual newspaper when I have this at my fingertips and I can go to all these different blogs that, they're all sourcing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So could you go a little bit into all the work that goes into an investigative piece and how that changes with the internet?
Yeah. Well, actually, you know what I'm going to do instead, because I mean, I think that you stated it very well right there, that there's a lot of work that goes into the background of each story, and that's what ends up getting transmitted over. I want to talk about something different, which is the model of the Indy Media Center in Seattle in November of 1999, which I think was transformative for our media today, especially our independent media. In 1999, a group of activists came together the week before the WTO protest to set up an independent media center in Seattle. And I was very peripherally a part of it, along with, you know, dozens of other people. And we took this empty space, converted it into a room full of computers, and then in came people who had never done journalism in their lives before. Maybe they were activists in some movement or other. But they were given the skills of writing, of using a video camera, of using a portable, at that time, mini disc recorders is what we were using. And then they were sent out into the streets to cover the events that were going on in Seattle. And on November 30th, 1999, the Indy Media site had more hits than CNN. And the reason for that was because CNN and all the Seattle television stations were reporting the stories from the mayor's press release. You know, the police in Seattle are not using rubber bullets. And the independent journalists, who didn't have, you know, were not beholden to the corporate interests, were going out in the streets gathering handfuls of rubber bullets, videotaping them, and putting them out across the internet for the world to see. And so the Indy Media model of mixing print, audio, and video and distributing it through the internet is something that had not really ever been done before. And what it did became a global sensation because it was able to convey the reality of the moment in a new and different and accessible way. since that time, you know, the internet has been an incredible benefit to all of us involved in any kind of independent journalism. You know, the difference between covering news in a foreign country where you used to, I worked in Nicaragua in the 1980s, and I would record stuff on a cassette tape, and then, you know, to send the cassette tape back to Madison by DHL or whatever the courier service was, you know, a couple hundred dollars or something, or you could feed it over the phone line. It would be scratchy and interrupted. And now people can go out with, you know, with a very inexpensive laptop computer, a portable digital recorder, a portable video camera, capture what's going on and send it almost instantly across the internet from an internet cafe or from, you know, the Wi-Fi in their hotel room and get those stories out in ways that we were never able to do before. And I'll share one other project that was that's sort of illustrative of this is in 2002-2003 I coordinated a project called Iraq Journal. And what happened was Jeremy Scahill, independent journalist, and Jackie Suen, an independent filmmaker, went into Baghdad, and they documented through a series of about 15 video reports and a number of print articles and photographs and so on, they documented what was going on the ground for the people of Iraq in the year leading up to the U.S. bombing and invasion of that country. And so we were getting these stories. They would – it's kind of a long and complicated story, but basically we had to send the video in little pieces over the internet. I reassembled it, sent it to Democracy Now!, and then it was transferred to tape, because back in those days we were still broadcasting using tape to get video on the air. This is all, you know, early 2000. And then they would show these, you know, full motion, high quality, you know, TV quality videos from the ground in Iraq that nobody else was getting out. CNN was paying something like $26,000 an hour for satellite time to get their stuff out of there. Fox News was paying Saddam Hussein, basically, something like, I forget what the numbers are now, but it was, you know, in the five and six figures to use facilities there in Iraq to get their news reports out. And here we were basically for free or close to it, running this website, getting these reports out that were telling real stories about real people in a way that none of the rest of the media was doing. So that's the power of the internet, and that's what technology has done for us in the independent media movement in terms of being able to get this stuff out. And now, of course, in the, you know, jump forward a decade and you have the, you know, the Arab Spring, where, you know, people are up there with flip cams, you know, recording things and sending it out over YouTube, and you have people tweeting on their phones. And so you have this instantaneous coverage, and nothing can be, you know, nothing can be hidden and suppressed in the way that governments often try to do and often have tried to do, you know, over years. This is a chance where independent journalists can go in and get out real news about real events that affect real people's lives.
Well, maybe on that note, I think that do you want to talk a little bit about media reform? Because I think that it's true that on the one hand, technology has made the access to independent media much more available and something that's in a lot of ways more democratic. But at the same time, it's also kind of flooded the world with all of this stuff. And I was listening to someone at some point that was saying that it's true that more books are being published today than at any point in history, but people are reading a smaller selection of those books, like in common. Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk a little bit about why it's important that that the structure of media is kind of taken on as a societal thing and not just kind of leave it open to technology to solve all these problems?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think the figure that I heard recently is that every day more video is created for YouTube than the entire history of Hollywood's production of wow. of film. But
got to go home and check my YouTube. Right. There's new things for me.
But what does that mean? I mean, you know, thousands of voices and no one to listen exactly is a problem. Now, the media reform movement is something that also grew up in the early 2000s and in part started here in Madison with the work of people like Bob McChesney and John Nichols and their organization Free Press that they co-founded. It was in response to an attempt by the FCC to further consolidate the control of radio, to allow more, fewer and fewer corporations to own more and more channels, basically. And so, again, it was a movement that began speaking out for diversity. Diversity of access, diversity of opinion, diversity of ownership. What's happened in recent years is that in some ways the battlefront has changed, and it's now the internet that people are concerned with consolidation and control of. And so a lot of work is being done around the issue of what's called net neutrality, which is basically saying that the internet is simply a vehicle for carrying information. It should be available equally to all sorts of information. The tendency in the world of corporate America and some of the regulatory bodies is to try and make the internet available to the highest bidder, to allow corporations to provide high-speed access to websites that are paying for that and lower-speed access to websites that are not paying for that. And so the phrase itself, net neutrality, is saying the internet should be a neutral platform. But the way that it's playing out is similarly this kind of corporate consolidation of ownership, that the internet would become a vehicle basically for corporations to showcase and sell their products. So in many ways, the media reform movement has moved beyond simply media to now discuss these issues. But the core element of it is still this desire for diverse voices, for localism, for local control against corporate consolidation. The Media Reform Conferences, which started here in Madison in the fall of 2003 and have gone on to be in many cities across the country, have also transformed a lot. There's a lot of people working on many, many different issues beyond simply media. Media education is a big one. There's been a lot more involvement of younger people, and the Media Reform Conferences used to be sort of policy wonkish, kind of, you know, what's going on at the FCC, what's going on in the, you know, Congress, and now they're much more about sort of hands-on, how are we doing these things in our community, and how can you duplicate that in your community? And so it's a really interesting movement to see its progression. But all of it, I think, boils down to this notion of localism and diversity being the only thing that will really allow us to keep developing. I think as a society, if you have only one point of view, you know, everything ends up looking gray, right? But if you have all these different points of view and all these different issues and interests and so on, then everyone benefits from that.
Well, I mean, part of that question also was kind of about the way in which the state gets involved with media, because I think one of the major differences between Europe or even Canada sometimes in the United States is the degree to which the government will subsidize the production of media and facilitate newsrooms and stuff like that, where I think a lot of people have used the development of technology to say that that doesn't even matter anymore.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that most developed countries in the world, along with many what they call underdeveloped countries, put more money into their media per capita than we do in the United States. In the United States, there's always been this notion of, you know, if it's government funded, that means it's government controlled, that means that it's propaganda. Well, in fact, you know, what we have is a system that's propaganda, but it's propaganda for the corporations because they're the ones that are paying for it. Mm-hmm. In most of the rest of the developed world, and Western Europe being pretty high on this list, they put a lot more money into their public media because they think, correctly, that it's about making people better citizens, better participants in a democratic process. You know, when we have there have been a couple attacks on funding for public broadcasting over the last several iterations of Congress, and in fact, since public broadcasting was created in 1967, there have been attacks, mm-hmm. but a couple of pretty prominent ones in recent years. And when Newt Gingrich went after the funding for public broadcasting in 1995, we wrote a letter and we said, you know, no, that not only should you not cut funding for public broadcasting, you should increase it, because public broadcasting is, and public broadcasting with a small p, you know, meaning us and community radio as well as everybody else, is an essential component of a free and democratic society, because we provide people with information to be able to make informed decisions. The way the democratic system in the United States works is, you know, people become informed about issues, they express their interests and desires to their elected representatives. Their elected representatives vote for these issues in Congress, and then laws get written, right? That's, I mean, the principle behind it.
I'll ask one last question on this, and I'll turn it over to you, Tessa. But I think that these media issues in particular are often seen by people on the left as a liberal concern primarily, and not something that they should be worried about. And I was wondering if maybe you want to comment on that, because I don't think that the far left has typically been all that interested. I mean, I think that they've been interested in using community media when it's available to them, but not as participants so much in extending it. Or, you know, do you want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, at the risk of sounding trite, in Lenin's book, What Is to Be Done, he says the first thing a movement has to do is have a newspaper. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that you know, not trying to reduce that down to you know, an ideological statement, but I think that you need a way to give voice to the issues that are of concern to the communities that you're working with. And whether that's a newspaper or a newsletter or a radio station or whatever, media is not a peripheral issue. Media is a tool that allows you to communicate and to build community as well. And so, you know, in the sense of community radio, which is where we're sitting right now as we record this, there is a community around this radio station which is much larger than the number of people that actually work at this station. It's the community of Madison. Noam Chomsky, in the film Manufacturing Consent, talks about WORT. Mm. And he says you can tell a community that has a good community radio station because it ripples throughout all aspects of that community and all the organizing and all the political work that goes on. And that in, you know, a community like his, Boston, where there wasn't a lot of community radio at the time when this film was made, he says you can feel the lack of that. And so I think that that's, you know, a good example of what a community radio station does as a tool for a movement, but also, you know, as a part of building the future that we're all looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as I've been engaging in independent media only very recently, something that I've always looked into and have been kind of irritated with in the radical left is that every movement does need media access and does need to put its stories out there and, you know, sure, a newspaper, but the idea of having a particular line newspaper where this is our line and this is, I mean, it is a propaganda piece. It's a propaganda piece for a particular movement. That's great and that's needed for that movement to get its ideas out. But to me, that's very different than a community radio station where it's saying, here's access to your own airwaves and here's people's stories. And the politics on WORT change between shows. There are people with multiple different political ideas that can all come together and share those ideas with the community. And that builds a different sense of investigative journalism, of listenership, of all of that, that doesn't have to incorporate, well, you have to agree with me or this isn't your product. So that's something that I think needs to get highlighted in the importance of community radio. I just wanted to touch on and have you expand on talking about the influences of WORT in Madison.
Sure. And I didn't mean to be reductionist by implying that WORT has a particular political line, because you're right. It's interesting because I've done a lot of work in Latin America with other community radio stations, and those stations are all much more sort of narrowly defined by a political line and are part of specific social movements for the most part. Whereas, you know, here in the United States, our community radio stations tend to be much more broad. The mission statement of WORT, the two components of it that I'll just note for a second. One is giving voice to the unrepresented and underrepresented segments of our community, and that's that's where we see ourselves sort of as counterposed to corporate media. But the other place that's kind of interesting is we call it challenging the cultural and intellectual assumptions of the listening audience through unique and diverse programming. And the thing I like about that is it's kind of like, you know, if you walk down State Street and say, what kind of music do you want to hear on the radio? And people say, oh, I want to hear Madonna 24 hours a day or whatever the current Vogue thing is. And it's because they've never been exposed to the Bulgarian Women's Vocal Choir or the throat singers of Tuva or sometimes even Ani DeFranco, you know. And we bring all those things to Madison. So one of the things that WRT does in its cultural programming is showcases all of these different artists and all of these. It's like Reader's Digest of the air, in a sense. You know, we give you little snippets of all these things, and then you can decide yourself what you're interested in. And so a lot of the international music scene in Madison would not be what it is without WRT having showcased these artists ahead of time and building audiences for these shows. Similarly, you know, in other genres as well, jazz, rock, folk, I mean, WRT is broadcasting all of those different types of music and a much more diverse panoply of artists than you would get on any commercial airwaves or even all of the commercial airwaves combined. You know, there's nobody else that's playing bluegrass every week in Madison except for us. You might hear a bluegrass song on a radio station on a particular week. I kind of like to compare it to the travel agency problem. If you go to a travel agency and you say, I want a trip to Germany, you'll have one kind of experience. If you go to a travel agency and say, I want to go on vacation, where should I go? You'll have a very different experience. Well, that's what WORT is, and it's because we have this pool of 300-plus volunteers, each of whom is knowledgeable and passionate about something, their particular kind of music, their particular interest in an issue, an organization, whatever. People bring those things to the table and share them with the listeners. And so you have, you know, a jazz pianist who's playing a jazz music show. You have a country music historian who's doing a country music show. And so they're bringing their wealth of knowledge, experience, and passion to the table and then sharing that with the listeners. And that's the kind of thing that that influences a community in ways that, you know, commercial stations simply don't have. I mean, they're just playing a particular narrow view of some kind of music that oftentimes has been created by, some computer in Los Angeles that says these are the top 10 songs. Well, we have people that are saying, well, what's on the B-side of that single? What's the obscure track? What's the history? What are the connections between those songs? I interviewed Johnny Clegg one time, South African musician, and he was talking about the connections between township music in South Africa and the Celtic music that he grew up with as a small child in England. You know, and that's the kind of stuff that only community radio can provide. The one other thing I want to touch on is about news and public affairs programming, that again, we bring discussions of issues to the table at length in the way that commercial media cannot. And so if you want to talk about sort of how do you influence a community, we provide people with the information, with the access to the newsmakers in a long form way. So, you know, while commercial stations will have political advertisements, we have the candidates on for conversations and discussions. And so people actually get to hear about the issues from the mouth of the person they may or may not be voting for. And so that's the kind of thing that a community radio station is able to do because we're unaffiliated and non-corporate, that and because we operate in this long-form way without being interrupted by, you know, advertisements every 10 minutes.
Why don't we talk specifically about this then? I think a lot of people can have a conversation about independent media being a good in the abstract, but radio in specific is something different. And I think that the format of radio is special and has its own challenges and benefits. And do you want to talk about radio as its own thing and not just independent media and the whole umbrella of it?
Sure. And I mean, I'm pretty old school about this. I still think of radio as being live radio, uh-huh. Even though, you know, obviously a lot of the programs are also archived on the web for later listening. And the big discussion right now in the industry is, you know, appointment listening is a thing of the past, that people don't go to listen to a particular program. They go back and listen on their iPods or their computers or their cell phones in many cases now. Mm-hmm. Well, in a sense, community radio is a little bit different in that I think there still is a lot of appointment listening with community radio. People still do tune in to, you know, their favorite program at this particular time. But people are also using it in these new ways, these new media ways. Radio is still the only thing that can go that last mile. Broadcast radio is still the only thing that can go that last mile where the technology isn't. You know, radio can reach places that television can't reach. It can certainly reach places that the internet can't reach. Mm. And, you know, you think about, like, in South Africa, where they came up with this little radio, the Baygen was the name of the company, but it's a crank and solar-powered radio. Because the biggest problem people had in getting access to radio was not having batteries. Mm-hmm. And because the batteries would, you know, would die or corrode or whatever in the, you know, in the heat, and then you wouldn't have the radio anymore. So they developed this radio that people could use even without batteries. Well, radio can be heard in places where there are no internet connections, where there are no telephone lines. I was actually in a conference in El Salvador in 1998, where we were talking about this issue, and this Guatemalan farmer came up and said, you know, in our communities, we don't have telephone lines, we don't have electricity, but we have radio, and that's how we can get news and information. Radio is something you can get, you know, in the car, you get it when you're, you know, you can carry it around. In fact, I've got a radio in my pocket. You can carry it around and listen, you know, when you're walking around outside. The smartphone technology is changing some of that, because now that, at least in the connected parts of the United States, you know, you can get 3G and even 4G in some places connectivity. You can listen to the radio over your cell phone in without actual radio waves. It's, you know, listening to the internet broadcast of radio. But that's not true in all of the United States, and it's certainly not true around the globe. And so radio remains a vital way of reaching people. And in times of disasters, so think about like Hurricane Katrina, when all of the internet connections were down, but you still had people broadcasting news and information over small radio stations. And of course, the ham radio network is to be praised a lot too. You know, individual people that are using radio technology to get messages out, especially in times of emergency. But radio stations were able to keep going and to transmit information that was essential to people. And then when the folks evacuated from New Orleans and they were in the Astrodome in Houston, there was a group that set up a radio station and provided small radios for people, again, to be able to get information in that place where they had no access to any other kind of technology.
I mean, and part of the question, too, is because I think people take in information differently with radio than they do with television or print. I mean, I work with Frank on Labor Radio, and what he was saying is part of the reason why they do Workers Independent News is because the permeability of radio is so much higher that people retain that information better than they do when they read something. And I think that that's an important part of this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my favorite story is, you know, I've hosted a lot of public affairs talk shows mm-hmm. here at WRT, and I've also done programs on the community television station, WYOU. And I'll be in the gas station, you know, and I'll be bumping my car, and someone say, "Oh, I saw you on TV." And I said, "Oh, well, what was I talking about?" I said, "Well, I don't know. You know, I was just spinning the dial, but I saw you on TV." That same person or somebody else like them in that gas station, not only can they talk about what the topic was, they can oftentimes quote the callers. Mm-hmm. "I really liked it when that guy called in and asked that question about such a," you know, it's a whole different way, exactly as you're saying, of getting, of internalizing that that content. And radio is pretty unique in that way. I mean, print, you know, people read print and they may or may not retain it depending on what their, you know, their reading style is. I mean, I tend to skim print stuff pretty quickly. But if if you're listening to it, you can also be doing something else,
right.
But you're taking that in. And in the case of something like Workers Independent News, you know, you drive around, you see a construction site, and there's a bunch of folks up on the roof hammering away, and they're listening to a radio while they're working on the roof. Or you're listening to music on the hold, hold on the telephone, and it's oftentimes a radio station. Or you're in a coffee shop waiting for your order, and there's a radio playing. Or you're in an elevator, and there's radio playing. So the role of radio, I think, is much underrepresented. People, if you ask them, where do you get your news? They say, oh, I get it from, you know, TV or the newspaper. Or nowadays, people probably say the internet. But in fact, if you look at the way people consume media, a lot of it is actually coming to them through the radio.
And the flip side of that, too, is that people seem painfully aware of Rush Limbaugh and of the right-wing radio stations and stuff like that. I don't know that, you know, that link has been made that a lot of people are listening to the radio while they're doing all kinds of activities, and they are aware that these right-wing ideas are being generated through the radio, but then they don't quite think about, you know, the role of the radio in terms of how you might combat that or using the community station to more properly inform someone.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Rush Limbaugh's model, two things about the Rush Limbaugh model. One is that the way they got that program going is that they would buy time on other radio stations, and they would broadcast the show, and then they would say, well, we have so-and-so many listeners because we bought time on the station. They didn't say bought time. And then they would get advertising dollars because they had so-and-so many listeners. And then that was sort of like a stair step to build that network. The other thing that they do is they give away radios in other parts of the world. And so, like, Rush Limbaugh on shortwave can be heard all over Latin America because they're giving away these radios to people. That model was actually initially developed by Pacifica. In 1949, when Pacifica KPFA in Berkeley, the first Pacifica radio station, got its start, it was on the FM band. Nobody had FM radios yet. FM was a brand new service. In fact, it had just moved from 1948 to the frequencies that it's on today. FM used to be lower on the dial. Mm-hmm. And so they actually had to give away radios to get listeners to the early broadcasts of Pacifica. So it's certainly a tried and true model. And I think that you're right that people oftentimes don't in left or progressive organizations realize the importance of media. And so that's why you see a lot of the right-wing foundations that fund people to think, these think tanks and so on. They're funding media in ways that the left-wing or progressive foundations tend to fund soup bowls. You know, how many people did you serve, right? And they don't fund media in the same way. They see it as peripheral. And that's always been a disadvantage, I think, that the independent media has faced, is that the possible funding sources don't realize the value of the product that they're not funding.
Well, and then, you know, we can kind of pull together your Lenin quote a second ago in this thread here, because I think that one of the things that's interesting is that maybe a lot of the far left still hasn't even entered the 20th century, because what is to be done is kind of it's at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, and it's still worried about the newspaper as mass media in a way that was maybe a new thing for the socialist movement at the time. And, you know, radio has been something that is a very 20th century thing, and television is not even on the radar at all. So, I mean, people are starting to talk about the role that the internet can play, but they're using it in a way that's very similar to the newspapers still. They're saying, we'll create this kind of objective news media propaganda, and I kind of was wondering, you know, thinking about this conversation about how you can use that to propagate ideas, do you have any response to the way the far left has used its media? I don't know if you even think about those things anymore.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, what I was just saying about sort of the squandering of the resource, you know, the lack of support for media. It's interesting. I've been thinking about this a lot in the last couple of weeks, as we've seen the loss of Free Speech Radio News, which stopped producing at the end of September, as we've seen threats to many other independent media outlets and small bookstores and so on, that it's almost like we're going back to the days of the patrons in the Renaissance, you know, when you had to have like some king that liked your work in order to be able to afford to do it. And it would be a terrible shame if independent media was forced to survive on the whim and the largesse of rich donors. It seems like, you know, we really ought to be more understood as an integral part of the movement of the work for change.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we all have busy lives to get back to, and so we'll probably start wrapping it up here soon. But I wanted to ask a few questions. I do a music show with Ward. It's live and local, and so I go around and record local bands. And there's nothing like walking into some bar in a group of people I've never met before in Madison and being like, "Hi, I'm from Wart." And instantly everyone's like, "Oh, Wart, great, lovely. Like, what do you need? Here's our music. Here's like the spot in the middle." Like, the audiences are always so like courteous. They never bump into my stand. They're always like, "Oh, don't talk around the recording. You know, it's for Wart." And so you can see those influences in Madison. And I was just wondering if you had a favorite moment or story or sort of movement where you saw like a real like effect of Wart on a particular movement, or a story you were able to help bring to light that really showcased how important this station is.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many to count. It's hard to say. And I know the ones that I've been involved with, but I'll try to talk about some of the ones that were larger. There was a case in the mid 90s here in Madison where there was a fire in the south side of Madison, and it turned out tragically that the law enforcement and folks that should have been responding to this situation were actually kind of joking about it on their radios because of the neighborhood that it was. And as it happened, there was a Wart volunteer who was also a dispatcher at 911, and they provided that information to a reporter here, and it became a story which then resonated, you know, throughout the city and resulted in some response from the city government. Similarly, in 1991, and these are all old stories. I'm just grabbing these off the top of my head. Right. In 1991, during the Persian Gulf War, we got a phone call from a person who was a Madison resident who happened to be in Saudi Arabia. And this person was told us over the phone about this missile strike that had happened in this town in Saudi Arabia, which wasn't being reported anywhere. According to the U.S. press at that time, there weren't any Scud missile attacks against Saudi Arabia. So we reported on that here, and then we also shared that audio with CNN. And then I just happened to be like watching the TV coverage of some press conference, and I think I'm blanking on the name of the White House press spokesperson at that time, but he's up there, you know, and this reporter says, "Well, what about the missile strike in Jubail, Saudi Arabia?" And you could see this sort of deer in the headlights look in his eyes. You know, how did they know about this, right? So he had to like do this quick, you know, "Oh, well, we heard about the, you know, whatever." But it was obvious that, you know, here, a little tiny community radio station with an entire news budget at that time for the entire department that was less than $20,000 was scooping CNN and was providing this addition to the national dialogue, small as it was, but it just shows the kind of things that can happen when you use this grassroots bottom-up approach where you talk to the people that are on the ground in the places where things that are happening instead of relying on the press release from the top.
And you probably should have sent CNN a bill after that for the like $26,000 or whatever you were saying per hour that they were paying. So,
well, I think you've made a wonderful case for community radio, as we were hoping you would. But are there any sort of, you know, step forward that you want to talk about? What the fight for independent media in this day? What should people be doing? How should they be engaging in their movements and with independent media?
Well, right now, this week, as we're recording this, is the deadline for filing applications for low-power FM stations. And so we will probably see in the next 1 to 3 years a lot of new stations coming on the air around the country. This new, it's called the Local Community Radio Act that was passed by Congress that opened up the doorway for these new stations to be created. And now the FCC started taking applications during this time period. And by mid-month, they will close that window, and then these applications will be in process. And so all of these little stations are going to need help. They're going to need people to participate, to bring stuff to the table. You know, what do you have to bring to this potluck that is community radio in your area? And so I think that, you know, I would certainly encourage people out there listening to get involved in some way, either in your already existing local community radio station or in one of these new stations that's going to be coming on the air in the next couple of years. For you, as an individual participating in it, a very rewarding experience, but also for your community, it's a chance to share what you have, your knowledge, your passion, your interest, your specialty with so many other people, and to help enrich everyone else's lives as well. So I think that, you know, that'd be the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is we all need to figure out how to get more funding for this kind of stuff, because it's getting harder and harder, and we don't want to cede this territory. We don't want to leave the ownership and control of all of our media to a few people like the Koch brothers with particular political agendas. We want to have a diverse, locally based, locally sponsored media network.
Okay, well, I think that's everything we've got. So thank you so much for taking a good hour with us.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Okay.
All right.
'Cause they ain't the type of listening, and they sure ain't never gone.